This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Stop talking. We got a got a podcast to do. Damn it. All right. Are you all set?
I'm set.
You got your notes?
I got a lot of notes, but, you know, nothing probably I'm going to refer to, depending on how the conversation goes.
Probably right. Hey, Holly.
Hi, Dave.
Welcome to What Difference Does It Make?
Thank you. Welcome to What Difference Does It Make?
Holly's a little nervous because we have a guest in the house.
We do. I'm so excited.
Right. Our guest is Mr. Nick Bedding. I remember Nick back in the day. I just knew him from phone calls. It was some guy with a fake English accent that was trying to prove he knew music.
Now he has to pour it on today to make us know that it's genuine.
Yes.
Well, I feel very welcome. Yeah. I know, like a phony.
Yeah.
No. Welcome, Nick.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Yeah. Thanks for inviting me.
So happy to have you.
Yeah. So Nick is a music radio, music promoter. What would we call you?
Yeah.
Tell us about yourself.
I'm a promotion guy. Yes, I am indeed a promotion guy. But what a promotion guy is someone that works for a artist that takes their music, their singles, to radio. And I've been privileged to be able to do that for a good few years, and I love it. I can't play a lick, so it's as close as I can get to the action, and it's super fun.
When you love music and when you love radio, be in the thick of it all the
time.
It's
a good combo.
It's a treat.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we will get into you at you worked at Capitol and you worked at Hollywood.
I did.
Had a cup of coffee at an industry magazine, I remember.
Thank you for bringing that up, Dave.
Those were good times. So we're gonna dig into all that.
Oh, I want to know who you worked for.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. So we'll kind of lead up. We'll start the childhood, and because I don't believe Nick is an American. We just learned that he just recently became an American like a decade ago.
That's a good thing, Dave. I'm very happy to be an American.
Okay. Yes. When you're going to get rid of that accent finally?
No, mate.
Don't get rid of it. It's charming. Yeah, I'm partial to it.
Yeah. So,
to an English accent.
So we always do talk about the 80s, as apparently this is what the theme of our podcast is. And Nick grew up in England, which is what we were fascinated with.
In the 80s.
Yes.
Yeah.
And just the style, the music, fashion, dance, everything. And apparently you were 14 years old, right in the thick of things, right when a young Nick Bedding was budding and learning all about things.
Yes.
So what was the first single or album you ever bought?
Ooh, good question. Well, I would say the song that probably really kind of brought me into like, oh yeah, I'm feeling this, was Gangsters by the Specials.
Really?
I know that doesn't surprise you, Dave, because I am a ska person.
How old were you?
I was in high school in the UK, so I was probably about 12, 13, somewhere in that zone.
Okay.
And I remember I was in the car, my mama picked me up, and we were driving home from school, and it came on Capitol Radio.
Isn't it good to know Capitol Radio?
And I was like, we have to go and get this. And there was this little record store on this bridge that went over the train tracks and we went there and I went inside and you remember that two-tone label. That was pretty cool. So that was the first record that I ever really, that was like a turning point for me. But then from that point on, I took the train up to London to the HMV shop to get the fresh out of the box Haircut 100 Pelican West album.
And so HMV, that was your go-to place?
Well, we had smaller record shops in Croydon where I grew up, but like to get stuff quickly, you had to get up to town to get it, and that was evidently a big priority for me. Nick Haywood went to a rival high school of mine. I went to Langley Park. He went to Kelsey Park. And so he was kind of a cult hero in the SE20 area of London. So, yeah, I went up to town to get that one. And then also the other big moment for me was Cool and the Gang. Yeah, I was all over. But again, this is, you know, London in that particular time, there was a big, you know, soul jazz funk thing going on. And then I was sort of discovering all this sort of new music that I hadn't really been exposed to, even though my mom and dad, my mom's only 20 years older than me. So she grew up in the 60s and Trojan reggae was a big thing. So I've always had sort of reggae around in my life. So I think when I heard the Specials, I was kind of like, whoa, what's going on here? A friend of ours, when I was a kid, his brother worked in London and he would always bring home these 12 inches of Spandau Ballet. Joy Division, and we were like, what is he listening to? This is pretty cool.
Well, I was going to ask you about your mother, because the fact that you just asked her to stop at the record store when you heard the Specials on the radio, and she did, they fostered your love.
Only child, you know. God bless my mom. She was always like, oh, well, we'll do that. So it was good. Yeah.
Did you know what the Specials looked like? I mean, when you got the album, I mean, because it's, they had a unique look, but this was just based on the sound.
That was absolutely based on the sound. So, of course, when I actually saw the look, I was in. I was like, oh. And again, my parents grew up in the 60s, quintessentially mods, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that was always a little bit built in for me, I think. And so, when I saw the style, I was like, oh, yeah, this is cool. And certainly jumped to emulate that pretty quickly. As I sit here in a Fred Perry today.
Yeah. You've evolved. Good. Everybody, style changes. It's good.
Not for Nick.
keeping it real.
Okay. And what was your first, did your parents take you to any concerts? Or what was your first show? What do you remember?
I'm pretty proud of this one, you guys. Okay. This is my first show. And it was at the Lewisham Odeon, I want to say. And I had to take the bus from Croydon into Lewisham, which at the time was a pretty rough area of London. But
and you were how old at this time?
Well, if I came here when I was 15, so yeah, I was like 13, 14.
All right.
So, I know, it's crazy, right?
Right, I know.
Sending your kids off on the bus to a concert.
I know. My mom and dad did pick me up, which that's a whole other story.
But that is awesome.
But, I was laced up in my two-tone tonic pants and loafers. I was ready, Dave.
Okay.
And it was the Selector.
Is that right?
Mm. It was the Selector with the Body Snatchers, which was it was just great. I mean, you can imagine.
That's so much cooler than anything you or I could say about our first concerts.
Taking the bus to, in our two-tone shoes.
It was,
see the Selector instead of.
Yeah, it was good. That's a fun memory. And again, simply because, you know, that was the first time that you feel like you're a part of something. Mm-hmm. You know, and again, I obviously had a lot of love for music. And as I said, there was this sort of, we used to call them soul boys. You know, they were listening to like Shack Attack and Level 42. And that was kind of like the London thing. And you sort of like become a part of that. But then as the ska thing began to evolve, I definitely was like, yeah, I'm feeling this. And obviously, you know, The Jam, The Secret Affair. There was like the mod thing that was happening on that side, and you know, you're a kid, so you're kind of like morphed into both of those, which is a poser, you know. But nevertheless, I was young enough to get away with it. But both, I mean, The Jam, obviously, Paul Weller has been a major influence for me over the years, and again, reggae or ska has also been just a passion for me.
It's so funny that you referred to it as a poser, as being a poser, because I, you know, Dave gave me just a little bit of background before this conversation, and I thought, God, I remember those years and, you know, love the music, probably not as well versed. But I wondered, what I wanted to ask you, Dave, was when you were in high school, I know the whole mod ska thing was, there were a few kids at school, you know, that dressed that way and listened to the music. And I thought, wow, this is really cool, you know. But if I take that on, I'm going to be a total poser, you know, because I don't know enough. Did you at your?
Oh yeah, I was totally like that. Yeah, I can't relate to to ska kids. I dress, you know.
But you
Southern
want to be
California,
the part. You want to look like it. You want to look the part, but you want to be the part. And I don't know if I could genuinely be the part.
No, no one could do that.
But
actually, I have a friend of mine who adapted to the UK style, tried to dress like a mod.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a funny story. He was dressed as what he felt that was very cool and hip, and you know, because he was into that scene.
Mm-hmm.
There happened to be a talent scout or someone who was going. We're waiting in line for a movie, and this woman saw him, and she's like, "Do you act?" And it, like as a joke,
based
like,
on the clothes you're like, wearing,
it's like, yeah, like, whatever. It's like, you know what? You'd be perfect for this movie that we're working on. And so it turns out the movie was 16 Candles, and he played Cliff, and he was like the nerd. He was dressed so he was dressed cool. This woman saw him was like, "Oh, this is perfect for him because he is clearly not a good fit for
not
this.
Not a conformist.
He doesn't fit into this look." Which is probably how we all felt, but obviously he was called out on that. Like he felt he was super cool.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah. Basically, I dressed like a surfer dude because, you know, I had my Ocean Pacific and my, you know, lightning bolt shirts. That's what I wore. I wasn't, you know.
Well,
that was much more common here.
Well, and again, moving here at 15, you know, that was a pretty big transition in my.
Did you take that fashion too?
Oh, you're really going to make me put this out there.
Yeah, so, I have to.
No, so we moved here and we moved to Valencia, Saugus area. That's where.
Awesome
that's
town.
Where, the awesome town. That's where I went to high school. And so I came. We came in May, and then so we started summer school. It was health and driver's ed. So I was ready, Dave. I was ready.
Back when they gave driver's ed in high school.
You had to drive on the other side of the road.
Oh, it was very complicated. But I didn't drive in the UK, so it was all relative.
Okay.
But so I show up for my first day of summer school, and I am just laced up in like maroon pants, maroon shoes, maroon shirt,
still
maroon sweater. It's like 100 degrees in Valencia, and I'm just like, I have arrived. And your look, Dave, your look, the OP look with the Journey shirt, I mean, that was kind of like the thing, right? And
of course.
Oh, my God. Needless to say, I made a quick dash to get a pair of Vans, some OPs. I needed to fit in pretty quick, which I did. I went and did that. I was like, I need to have this stuff because I look like a fish out of water.
And being an only child, your mother ran out and got you everything you needed.
I'll say it again. God bless my mom. So, and that was a pretty short, you know, period of time, like that summer school. And then, you know, you kind of, as a teenager, you know, I was trying to fit in and things were, you know, music was changing. And, you know, I brought probably about 100 smash hits with me from the UK. And, and again, I somehow, you know, I'd already had like the 12-inch of like See You by Depeche Mode. I mean, and I think that was the other point I wanted to touch on is that, you know, music did... It kind of moved quickly in London, you know. It was like, I'm not saying that the Specials went away or Madness went away or any of that thing went away, but like the trends kind of evolved. And I think that radio certainly played a big part in that. So when I went back to high school, I knew I had to fit in, but I definitely was like, I was a little bit of a fish out of water. And thankfully there was a kid that lived close to me by the name of Chris that took me under his wing and it all worked out.
It's terrible when you're that age and you're feeling like, I mean, we all felt like we had to fit in, but you have your stuff that you like, your music that you like, your clothes that you like, that's not that other 15-year-olds aren't accepting that. And it's a whole other conversation, I realize. But right out of the bat, you know, right off the bat, that you feel like you have to change when you're really passionate about what you like.
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, as you say, being a teenager is complicated, and I will say that having, you know, once I became friends with this guy Chris, he was the one that sort of, I know it sounds weird, but like when you're on your own, you kind of feel like, oh my God. But then once I had someone sort of wingmanning me, I kind of felt more confident to like own kind of my space. But yeah, music was the and you touched on it. Music was the driver. Mm-hmm. I mean, 100%. That's what shaped my whole vibe, my look, and you know, I mean, that was just it.
You had a nice dress rehearsal for summer before yes. before the real season and the fall starts. Did you meet you met Chris in the summer? Is that
I met him when I went to Saugus High School. I met him when I started there.
Yeah. Oh, okay,
yeah. So it was fun. It was good. It's great guy. He works for Spotify now. So look at that. Right? Yeah.
How about that?
How about that?
So you knew who to gravitate to because.
Well, you know, we all sit in here because we're music geeks, right?
So that's what I mean. So it started early on with you. Like, I'm going to go to Spotify. You know, that's a
good journeys. Good journeys.
Yeah. So all right. So you kind of had to acclimate to what'd you listen to? I mean, obviously you had your thing. And when did you start listening to when you came to Valencia? You had a few LA radio stations. Were you listening to radio, or was it? Did you rely on other people?
There was no Spotify or cassettes. I know
there was. Yeah, there's no HMV in Valencia.
I really did rely on my own music, probably simply because we were out there and K-Rock was in existence, but the signal was rough up there. I mean, the comedy is we would listen to it, you know, scratchingly, like, oh, what are they playing? You know, it was that curiosity. And then somewhere along the line, Chris's brother became a DJ at a local radio station in Valencia or Canyon Country or something. So we'd just like call in requests, and I think like Chris was like lacing him up with like records to play and stuff, you know.
So, so
it was some good comedy. But yeah, it was, I was really, as I say, when I came here, you know, I had sort of gone through this arc of what was the Specials all the way through to, you know, having Depeche Mode records in my collection. And so, yeah, I, you know, I listened a lot to that, and I was still pen palling with friends from the UK. Mm-hmm. So they would tip me off to what was happening. And it was weird things like Kid Creole and the Coconuts. And you're like, really? That's big there right now. But, but again, the trends moved pretty fast through London, I think, back then. But yeah, so that I was living in my own space with smash hits and trying to turn on people like, hey, have you heard this?
Did anybody take to it? What were they listening to, and did they turn you on to any of?
Well, I think, again, it was pretty mainstream at that point, right? Because we didn't have the access that we have today.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to say that probably, and I'll go back to Chris again here, where, you know, there was a punk in school, kind of like the one guy.
I had that one guy.
Yeah, and his name was Rio, and he was kind of like the cult hero at school, and Chris was friends with him. So obviously, I think at that point, the Clash was probably in, you know, kind of floating in that ether, and Chris had certainly gravitated towards stuff like that. And then obviously, as the 80s started to unfold, because that was 82, you know, it was just like all of a sudden, here comes all this music, and, you know, Planet Earth came out in, 81, I want to say. Mm-hmm. So as it started to evolve here, I was kind of like, well, yeah. This is going to be good. I'm English. They're English. He's my uncle.
Yeah.
You can say that. Nobody would know.
I never played that card.
Did your fashion start to change again? I mean, obviously, from Maroon to Ocean Pacific, did you go back to...
100%. Yeah, 100%. I at that point, I started to, you know...
But where do you shop? Where do you go?
That's a good question.
Thrift shop. Yeah. Aardvark at the time?
I don't know. He's in Valencia. Yeah. He has no access to a car.
But we would fantasize about the idea of going down to Melrose. And, yeah. Oh, man, if we could just get down there, because none of us had a car at that point. I think, you know, I was probably pretty straight ahead in what I was wearing. But, you know, would try to change it up a little bit. And when my mom would go and my mom's family was in the UK. So when she would go, she'd bring something back that was trendy and I'd wear it out, you know. But, you know, we certainly would emulate as much as we could with what we had. And then, you know, one way or another, you're like, I think I look good. Looking back, I'm not sure. But it was fun.
Let's take a break right now.
Now? Already?
Yeah, it's time.
I feel like we just got here.
All right. Well, let's get some donuts.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Talk hair then.
So obviously, you know, getting a good haircut's a part of, you know,
the whole look.
Being the part. So I Dave. I love you. So I in high school they offered an occupational program.
Yeah.
And one of it was beauty school. Oh yeah. So I was like, this seems like a perfect place for me to spend some quality time. And I did. I went and I got my my license. So when I graduated high school, I actually graduated with my cosmetology license. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that was all.
That's amazing.
But certainly all driven from, you know, music, fashion, hair. I kind of was like, you know, this all works together. So that was kind of like my driver. I think I was like, oh yeah, I want to give really cool haircuts.
Did you?
You know, I mean, I may have had my moments, and I certainly thoroughly enjoyed working in that business. I mean, again, it was incredibly creative, and yeah. At that time, I mean, I'm jumping around a little bit here, but like I started working at a shop called Carrera, which was made up of like these hipsters that all lived in the valley, and it was a funky little shop. It was like, you know, the makeup artist was English, and, you know, they all looked like they just stepped out of Prince's band, and it was, you know, I was definitely a fish out of water myself there. But it was super cool, and I ended up working for Sebastian Cassandra, which was a salon in the valley called Cassandra 2000, and it was like, wow. That was like, you know, you'd arrived. If you were getting your haircut there, you were like, woof, you know, come on. And so I ended up... Ended up getting a job there, and it was great. And then they opened a salon in Beverly Hills, and I went to that shop with them in an assistant role. And then Sebastian was coming on strong, right? And was so image focused. It was like the music, everything meant something. Jerry Cosenza is a visionary. You know, she created this incredible product and marketed it incredibly.
Yeah.
And so then I ended up working for Sebastian. at their center in Woodland Hills. And, you know, that's kind of where, you know, the stylists would do presentations and other hairdressers would come in, and it was super cool and I loved it. And I swear I was in the house for like, I don't know, a month, and then I think it's Wella came in and bought Sebastian and blew everybody out. I'm not a stranger to being unemployed.
I used to get my hair cut there. Yeah. When it was Sebastian. Is on DeSoto.
It's yeah, there. Absolutely. Yeah. The Pyramid.
Yep.
Yeah. That's a very, they have, it was a cool spot. Yep. It was a cool spot.
But, cut your hair.
But yeah, so that was, you know, that again, all of that was tied together. And I did meet a lot of people. And obviously at that point it was, you know, Scritti Politti. It was Dead or Alive. You know, it was that whole scene that was happening. And obviously the Prince scene and so on. And again, music just played such a huge part. And the guy that I worked for, Arthur, still a friend of mine, still cuts my hair. They were the ones that would, like, you know, sneak me into, like, power tools and stuff, you know. And I was like, oh, my God, I can't believe I'm here. And it was like the music was just the greatest. And, you know, you're just thriving off that whole scene. You're young, you're excitable, you know. And it was just, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. And it certainly shaped further of or shaped more of what I wanted to be or be into or allow me to be into. So, yeah, it was a fun little ride.
Sure.
That is a transition you wouldn't normally hear.
No, for sure.
He was Warren Beatty, man.
Picturing that right now.
Oh, yeah.
Not so much. Well, the thing about being an assistant at any, well, back then at any shop, you know, if they were working on a new style, it was like, hey, sit down, we're going to cut your hair. So I had some pretty interesting haircuts along the way. But yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun.
And then did you go directly from hair to music?
Oh, man, you guys are really going on me, aren't you?
Really interesting.
Why we have you sit there? Did you not know why you're here?
Did you know we were just going to talk about ska and mods? And
no, I love this. It's fun to relive it a little bit.
A little bit.
So a woman that I work with at Cassandra, her name is Marina. After the Wella bought the center and it changed, she called and was like, hey, I'm doing hair on this show called Top of the Pops. Would you be interested in being second hair? And I was like, yeah. Yes, oh. I would. And it was, what year is that? 87, I want to say, something around that point. Okay. Nia Peoples was the host. And it was kind of like where they would jump back and forth from the BBC show to the American show. And so it was a great opportunity to, one, get introduced to the entertainment business on that level. And, you know, I was meeting my new heroes and swing out sister, the lovely Corinne, and it was cool. It was a really good experience, and you know, I obviously grew up watching Top of the Pops, so it was a kind of like a, you know, a moment for me. And then through that, I ended up meeting the executive producer Troy Miller and Joel Gallen, who was the director. Joel ended up being the MTV, you know, head of production for them, and Troy Miller's gone on to be a very successful producer director himself. And they were like, you should come and work with us.
I know, this is a only great career arc.
This can only happen in the 80s,
right?
You should come and work for us. And so I did. I was like, I didn't have much to lose, but a lot to gain. And and they put me in the post-production department. Okay. And I had no idea what that was, but I was like, I'm here, I'm working on Universal Studios, this is incredible. And they put me in this room full of 3/4-inch tape and gave me a degausser and said, all these tapes need to be erased. I was like, well, wait, what? So I went
from
entertainment.
I can't leave show business.
It's a glamorous life. But from there, obviously, they, I feel very fortunate to have a lot of, and Troy was a great mentor in that scenario. And went on to work for a guy with Troy called Steve Binder, Binder Entertainment. And Steve Binder directed Elvis in the 60 comeback special. And so we did, that was just a super interesting space to be, because we were doing Pee Wee's Playhouse at that time and Super Mario Brothers Super Show. And it was like these sort of like trendy shows. And it was a great, again, another great experience, and certainly eye opening to what is available, because, you know, a kid from South London doesn't really think that he's going to either, one, become a hairdresser or work in Top of the Pops or, you know, whatever. So it was really fun to be a part of that. And again, it was young and it was energetic and it was awesome. And we worked for MTV. Well, when Joel went to New York, Troy and Joel were very tight. And obviously that we did a lot of the West Coast production for MTV, a lot of the wraparounds with Martha and all that kind of stuff. And it was great. And that's when I started really thinking, like, production's cool, but I do love music. how do I do this? And then we did a show called Skate TV for MTV Networks, and it was very heavily music based. It was a lot of montage stuff of skaters, and a super cool show. And I was like, this is making a lot of sense to me. I love, like, music against picture, and I was just definitely like, I had the bug at that point. I was like, I got to figure this out. And again, being English, I was like, there's just one stop for me, and it's Virgin Records. It's a true story.
Yeah.
It's a true story. And so I put, like, my best, like, trendy outfit on, and I walked into the lobby of Virgin.
What is your trendy? Yeah. What year were we? 88? 89?
Yeah, it's probably
okay.
88.
All right, so late. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So the best trendy outfit.
I think at that point I'd come back from the UK and I had a pair of those really like pointed, like, you know, like pointed shoes. And those were like, man, if you were rocking those, you were like, you're bringing out the big guns.
I'm picturing like creeper.
It was
like
a creepery type of thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And I got this jacket from, I can't believe I remember this, from American Rag.
Of course you do.
And I love that jacket. It was like just very cool, or at least I thought it was. So I wore that.
In 88 it was.
And I walked into the lobby and they were on Alden, and it was this place they used to call the bungalow. It was like this little house, and you know, you walk in and the lobby's very small and the receptionist was up high, and I remember like looking up like, hi, how do I get a job here?
Like Wizard of Oz, you're looking up at the
and the ignorance is bliss scenario, you know.
Way better off that way.
Yeah. Very much.
Otherwise
so.
We'd be just stuck in our own, you know, muck.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Sometimes I do get my own way, that's for sure. But it was one of those things. She was, do you have a resume? And I was like, yes. And I gave her my resume, and that was pretty much it. Mm-hmm. Off I went, and I was like, wow, I did it. I got my resume in there. And I kid you not, I get a phone call like 2 days later, and they're like, hey, we have a position open we'd like you to come in for. I was like, what? I did not get the job, but it was one of those things where you're like, I can't believe this is happening to me. Mm-hmm. And again, working for MTV, I was like lacing up the, you know, the HR woman with an MTV t-shirt, like, hey, don't forget about me. I was like doing promotion before I knew I was doing promotion.
Exactly.
And then I got a call and they were like, there's a job in the promotion department. And again, I say this, you know, I didn't know what promotion was. All I knew is I needed to get in the door one way or another. Mail room, didn't matter, just needed to get in the door. So I go in and I meet with a couple people, Tom and Iris, and they were great. And she did like crossover promotion, and then he did the AC promotion. And I was like, oh, this is good. And then I got the call back, like, they want to see you again. So I come back. And then I'm supposed to meet with Michael Plenn, who was a senior VP of promotion, and he was with Steve Winwood in Nashville. Can you believe I recall this stuff? It's insane. So they're like, you're going to be meeting with Phil Costello. And I said, okay. And so I walk into this office, and there's this guy sitting there. He's wearing John Fluvogs, got a cool haircut, he's smoking cigarettes, he's got, you know, CDs piled up everywhere. And I was like, oh my God, this guy is cool.
This guy.
I want to be like this guy. So, we had a great conversation, and you know, I was still at MTV, and I just done the MTV Music Awards, and it was like, you know, it was everything was kind of like it was all very current, and it all felt right. And he's like, well, you know, hopefully we can get you in here, and I was like, that'd be amazing. You know? And then I can't. This part's a little blurry, but then I just remember like Tom called me, and he's like, hey, I have great news for you with Iris, and they were like, we'd love for you to come in, and of course I was ecstatic. And. And then I was commuting from Saugus to Beverly Hills every day.
But that's what we did for our first early on in our
careers.
We were very happy to do that.
Absolutely.
Saugus. Why were you in Saugus? I mean,
that's where we actually officially lived.
Oh, okay.
We lived in Saugus, yeah.
Okay. You're like, yeah. I need to find a new place on my own.
Not yet. I definitely...
It's like a lovely, lovely place.
Okay.
I definitely hung on to home for as long as I could.
Yeah. I gotcha. Okay.
So yeah, that is a sort of in a nutshell how that all sort of came together. And
so you really made that happen. You're saying you lucked into that, but you said I want to work in music, and
I mean, you know, now that I look back at it and, you know, sort of reflection on college and I do definitely have like, I wish I'd have pursued that, but I was pursuing the hair thing. It wasn't like I wasn't interested in furthering that. It was just that my path went in a different space. And again, I feel very, very fortunate that I was afforded opportunities that opened my eyes wider and wider and wider as I was moving through the process. And so that's when I was kind of like, obviously the music thing was like sort of unattainable, right? You drive by the Capitol Records Tower and be like, how? Yep. Mm-hmm. You know, how?
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I'm working at Virgin at that point. It was just phenomenal. I mean, it was, you know, soul to soul, Public Image Limited. It was awesome.
Those were the years.
Let's end it right here, and we will pick up next week with more fun and shenanigans.
Until next week.
This is Dave.
This is Holly.
Check you later.
Over and out.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.